This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We're going to talk now more about the recent Porter County elections, the problems that were held on election night back in November, and how Porter County government is doing their best to resolve them. And we have with us one of the architects. I'm not going to give her all the credit because I know she has two colleagues in the Lake County Board of Commissioners that she's worked with very closely on this. But Laura Blaney seems to be the front person for a lot of what has come about and result. A 19-page document that has been submitted. You can look at this document, print it out if you want. It's on the Porter County Government website right now, I understand, Laura. First off, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Chris. Happy to be here.
Let's, I guess, go through all the gory details, if you like. Certainly, the unpleasant news that happened on election night that has seems to have prompted a lot of what has now resulted in this document, which may, like this, maybe clear things up in the future, won't it?
We're hoping it will.
Yeah.
It's a start. You can't fix something that you don't really understand how it's supposed to work in the first place.
When I guess the problems began, did they happen before Election Day, or does it seem that everything just came to a head on election night when you're trying to tally the vote?
Everything absolutely came to a head that day, but I think there had been some problems in the works that nobody really realized.
Mm-hmm.
The problems started in the morning when the polls opened late, some of the polls, I think 13. And that was the first sign that we had a problem. Unfortunately, the problems continued all day.
When folks started calling in, I guess, to the county government offices talking about, did all the calls, I guess, come into the voter registration office? Because typically that's where a lot of, I know, in the past, that's how the elections were kind of handled. It was kind of funneled in through the operations there.
Right. But they are currently handled by the clerk, so mm-hmm. a lot of calls were there. And I think the phones weren't getting answered or they were overwhelmed, and we ended up in the commissioner's office receiving many calls.
Mm-hmm. When you got the calls in, what did they start out as? Just polls opening late, primarily?
At the beginning, it was polling places not opening on time.
Uh-huh.
And that was a helpless feeling because we're not really involved and didn't know what to do to help get them open. But we were able to support keeping the polls open later at the end of the day so the voters who got turned away early could come back.
When did it finally end up being a case where you determined that when you got into the end of the evening,
mm-hmm.
That you weren't going to have the results ready?
Well, that started being apparent earlier in the day when the absentee ballots were not getting delivered to the polling places. They're supposed to come during the hours of the polling, between 6 and 6, per legislation, with the I don't know what the right word is, in time to be processed at the polling place within those hours.
So it wouldn't necessarily be a case where that whoever would get the polls set up at a particular precinct might have those, maybe they'd be in the cases or cases that they would take out there. But sometime during the day, they would have to have those received.
Yes.
So that come 6 p.m. or 7 p.m., the case may be, on election night, that they'd be ready to go in and be counted along with the rest of the machine votes.
Correct. They're usually not there first thing in the morning, but the sheriff's department would deliver them during the day.
That's one of the regular procedures.
Correct.
Did, from best indication, that until these particular problems cropped up here on election day this past year, everything seemed to be working well? Had you gotten any complaints in from the clerk's office or from the Board of Voter Registration?
No more than usual.
Yeah.
No more than usual. And the primary didn't seem to have too many problems, so there was no smoking gun waiting for us.
Now, I know that eventually when things got really bad that you decided that you wanted to help get some resolution to all of this, and that's
mm-hmm.
why you've turned to the Indiana Secretary of State's Election Division to help look into this.
Yes.
What would they be doing, or are they doing now, or have they reported back to you and the commissioners?
Well, they're going
about this?
To be reviewing procedures and policies and make sure things were followed and done properly and really just try to help us out and streamline things and make sure we don't have similar problems. problems in the future.
And I assume that in the meantime, that since November, that they've been in touch with you folks at the commissioners and talked about this, or have they given you any indication when they might have some information, or at least
I don't have a timeline, yeah. But they did tell us that they would report back to us when they're finished. Mm-hmm. So it's coming.
So I guess in the meantime, you wanted to, of course, get something together, take it into your own hands, waiting for all the reports to come from the state on what had happened on election night. And what, I guess, was the procedure that you all went through on the commissioners to come up with the basis for what is now this document that's available to look at?
Well, just one of the things we noticed, Chris, was we didn't have a lot of answers, and a lot of the people who were calling didn't know how things were supposed to work. Who should they be calling? Who's in charge of what? And we realized that there was no central location to find this. It's all in the law, but that's not an easily accessible thing for most people. So we just got together and decided to put it all in one place where people could refer to it and be educated.
Now, how much work did it take once you started this process of asking people in within county government how things have worked in the past and who's responsible? How long did it take you to get yourself to a point where you could get the documents together and put the flow charts together?
Several days. And, of course, our office staff helped a lot. But most of it's accessible on the state government site because it's law. So it was just putting it together in a way that made sense to people.
Did it seem maybe unusual is not quite the word, but at least different in this respect because of the fact that most other Indiana counties have this set procedure as well? Porter County has gone this route, and it's worked well for them, apparently, with a few hiccups along the way over the years here. But it wasn't until this election night and all the big problems that came about that they realized that for some reason the way that had been done before isn't going to work any longer.
Well, we did change what we were doing. Our voters registration office was handling elections, and it came to our attention, and for many, many years, as long as I've been involved, and longer. And it came to our attention, everyone's attention, that wasn't the way to do it under the law, under the current legislation. And so the election board voted to move it to the clerk's office, which was one of the options and under the law. And so it was only her. She did the primary and then this most recent general election.
Mm-hmm. Now we go to the point where you have the document ready. And as we mentioned, it's available on the Porter County Government website if you'd like to take a look at it and print a copy of it out. When you got the document together and got it all posted and all, what comments have you received from everybody who's had a chance to take a look at it and yourselves included as county commissioners?
We haven't had too many comments. It's kind of a long document and not the most exciting read. Maybe a good bedtime read. But there's a flow chart, several flow charts that really show you who belongs where. And, you know, it may have just help people direct calls and questions to the right places.
Does it seem that that's kind of the case now, that it's not necessarily, although you would want to know, but not necessarily knowing who's responsible for what. But in this case here in particular, if you have questions, if there are concerns, that you know now who to direct those to.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that was the main thing. You know, who should be doing this? Who do we call if there's a question? And it's helped us a lot in our office. And hopefully it will help the new clerk and anyone out there who has questions.
Now, I should mention here, too, that Jessica Bailey, who's a Democrat, has taken over as county clerk since the Republican Karen Martin was held back by term limits to seek a third term. Mm-hmm. And she, in turn, handed things over, I guess, through the clerk's office on January 1st of this year.
Yep.
Have you had a chance to sit down with her and talk in more detail about this? Or did she have enough time here after the election and between the election and the time that the document came out to have a chance to look it over herself?
She has, and she's been fantastic to work with so far, very proactive, just trying to take it all in. You know, you're drinking out of a fire hose for the first few weeks.
Well, like I say, when she's in a position like this here where the learning curve is very steep to begin with. You only have a couple months or maybe only a few weeks for that matter to be able to be more familiar with a position that you're not necessarily familiar with. Had she worked in the clerk's office before?
No, she worked for the Chamber of Commerce in Portage, but she clearly has done some homework. She's not starting from ground zero. You can tell when you have a conversation with her. And I'm sorry, but moving forward, this whole document may change because there's a bill that's going to be filed maybe today that Ed Salladay is putting forward that will change the way this is done a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And he's taken a lot of input from both parties, and I don't think it's in its final version, but we're hoping that that will help streamline things as well.
I know that Representative Salladay and Senator Karen Talion both worked very closely with you all, and they were the ones that are most concerned about everything that happened as a result of election night last November, and trying to get this resolved and get the problems squared away so that they don't happen again.
Absolutely. Karen called me this morning, but we've been playing phone tag, so I'm hoping to talk with her about this legislation as well.
Well, it sounds like here that if Representative Salladay gets this introduced here, which I know he's going to do here as the session is now underway, and he knows that that he's going to have us back with Senator Talion in the Senate, she'll carry it forth. If it isn't, she's not the co-sponsor, but she'll be the sponsor, I'm sure, in the Senate when this comes up.
I can't comment on how they're planning to move it forward.
They figured this out. I'm sure they've had a chance to consult and work this out. So
absolutely,
they can get this up and do their best to make sure that that all the members of the General Assembly are aware of this. They've had a chance to review it. It'll go through committee and all before it gets to floor votes and all.
Correct.
And before it goes, hopefully,
and they've
the
asked for
bill.
Local input, which is what we appreciate.
Mm-hmm. What kind of input had you, besides the comments, the angry comments, the concerned comments that residents made here because of the problems on election night? And of course, all this, of course, led up into the document itself coming through. From folks having had a chance to look at it, are they pleased? Have you heard some comments?
They are pleased. About it? I think they're just glad to understand what's supposed to happen so they won't feel so helpless if next time around, well, hopefully next time around this won't happen, but just to know who's supposed to be where, when, it's just empowering.
Are you under the impression that Representative Salladay and Senator Talion are doing here and getting legislation prepared to come up before the General Assembly will make this more official, even though it is already official? It's already in state law, but it just needs to be something that is firmed up in Porter County law?
Yes, and it makes some changes that I think are positive, and it just streamlines things and holds people accountable.
One of the things I know that always comes up here during election time, and since we're going through another cycle, only this time it's municipal elections rather than a countywide election, are you hoping that the changes that have been set forth in the document and revised, as you say, are going to happen over time, that this will make it a much easier process for the communities when they get all set up to have their primary elections in May and the general elections in November?
Yes, absolutely. I do feel that the people who are actually doing the work, they knew how it worked. This wasn't really for them. This was more for the public, for people that were maybe poll working for the first time, those sorts of people who just really wonder what went wrong, and they didn't even know how it was supposed to be. So, and we realized there were a lot of people that just didn't know. It had gone well for so long, no one really paid attention. It just became an expectation that you show up and cast your vote and it gets counted.
Did you have a chance to confer with some of your neighboring counties, Lake County and in LaPorte County in particular, where they already have the procedure all set up and running over the years, since it's a new procedure for you folks in Porter County?
I personally have not, because our procedures aren't exactly the same.
Yeah.
So we were very focused on our own.
So.
Yeah.
If anyone is interested and they'd like to find out more, we just kind of mentioned in a brief overview the fact that this document's available on the Porter County Government website. Tell us specifically where it is, so if people do want to look it up, go on computer and find it, and not only look it over themselves, but print it out as if they want to have some kind of reference point.
Yes.
And let me ask you also, too, along with that, as an education tool, because it's an education tool in a way, too, for
Absolutely.
Everybody, are the school systems going to, maybe they'll be able to have a chance to look at this
idea.
And take an opportunity
for
to put this
government
in
class, right.
And civics classes. You know, we know that's a way to help teach young people who are not maybe yet voters, but will be soon.
That's a fantastic idea. It is under porterco.org, and it's in the documents section of the website.
Porter County Commissioner Laura Blaney's been with us. She's a Democrat. She represents South County in Porter County, and she is one of the people in particular most responsible for helping work with others to gather the information together, craft this multi-page document that's available online for anybody to take a look at on how Porter County government elections should be conducted, who's responsible, how the layers of responsibility are set up, and questions, people know who to call. That's one of the important things that you mentioned at the outset here, that nobody knew who to reach to find out about answers to the questions they have. But this will spell all this out. It'd be easy to be able to figure out in the future. And Laura, thank you very much for spending time with us here to talk about this today. And we hope that all goes well, that whatever legislation that come out from State Representative Ed Soliday and State Senator Karen Talion that will help this document and just general how elections are held in Porter County.
Well, thank you, Chris. I appreciate it. And I think that everyone involved has learned from the mistakes. And moving forward, I doubt we'll see this problem again.
You're doing your best to certainly make that to be sure. Something to remember, to be sure. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Chris.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. A law that went into effect over the summer made previously closed adoption records available to Hoosiers who were put up for adoption between 1941 and 1993. It gives them the opportunity to access vital information, like the names of their birth parents. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier tells us, it's taking the state longer than expected to process and to release these records.
From the moment you step into Kathleen Anderson's home, it's obvious family means a lot to her. The word is featured prominently on several decorative signs that cover her walls, and there's a large assortment of family photos displayed above the fireplace. As we sit down in her living room, she shows me a picture of her three children from her daughter's wedding.
I mean, my daughter, she always gets how much she looks like me and sounds like me. My oldest son looks more like his dad.
But when it comes to who Anderson looks like, the picture isn't as clear. Bob and Jane Kelman adopted her at birth in 1968. A framed, worn portrait taken shortly after the adoption shows them dressed up with Anderson in Jane's arms. Anderson says it's their first family picture.
I kind of always like this picture because it really captures to me like the essence of who they were at that point in time. So proud to have me as their daughter.
Anderson says she's grateful for her adoptive family, but she's wondered her entire life about her origins. She has small tidbits of information, including her birth date, the hospital she was born at, and her mother's age, only 16 when she gave birth. Her adoptive parents also told her they agreed to raise her Catholic as a condition of the adoption. But Anderson wants to know more.
I guess I've just always wanted to know, what was my parents' story.
She hopes she could soon find out. A law that went into effect in July opened up previously closed adoption records. It gives Hoosiers put up for adoption during that time access to more information, which could include their birth parents' identities. Birth parents can contact the state if they wish to restrict any identifying information from being released to the child. But Anderson decided to take a chance and file the paperwork anyway. She submitted it to the state shortly after the law took effect in July.
I had expected at the time that I filed that, you know, maybe around Thanksgiving or beginning of December I would have it. Now I'm thinking it might be more like March or April.
The Indiana State Department of Health is in charge of processing the requests. The agency didn't make anyone available for an interview, but a media relations representative said in an email, the state has received more than 3,300 records requests under the new law. Nearly half of those came within just the first 2 weeks the law went into effect. The department says it's released just over 860 records. We are continually looking at ways to decrease the processing time, including hiring additional staff, because we know this information is very important to those who are seeking it, the email says. Anderson says she's frustrated by the long wait to get her information. Legislators passed the bill in 2016, but waited to put it into effect until 2018. The thinking was that would give the state 2 years to prepare. Anderson says she's not sure why the state didn't allocate additional resources to help, but she's hopeful the process will be worth the wait.
You know, I never thought I'd even get this opportunity. I've waited 50 years. A couple more weeks, months, in the grand scheme of things, isn't that long.
The state says it could take up to 20 weeks to process each record. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
By the way, Republican State Senator Randy Head is proposing a bill this year that would address another issue with the adoption records bill. It would make it clear that people are entitled to copies of their adoption records rather than just getting the opportunity to inspect or copy the information by hand. Lake County Surveyor Bill Emerson Jr. says his drainage crews are doing more work in removing debris this past year that seemed to be clogging up a lot of the ditches. Cleaner ditches means less possibility of flooding. And Emerson came on Regionally Speaking to talk about it. As he said first, that getting on the ditch cleanup list depends on several factors.
It kind of depends on the waterway itself. So we have to consider a lot of things. One of them being, for example, on Katie Marsh Ditch. It runs through Highland, Griffith, and then Cal Township, and it's a very flat area, so it collects a lot of sediment. The water doesn't always move as well as we'd like it to, so we do have to maintain that a little more often than other ditches. So we generally get to that every about 10 years or so is what we've been trying to do, or a little sooner.
The idea, I guess, to have the ditches, of course, is to allow agricultural areas to be more useful. Otherwise, they'd probably be flooded all the time. And also, too, I guess you have a lot of wetland area. Maybe people don't realize that, or maybe it seems that most of the wetland that is around in Lake County is all south of, say, U.S. 30.
Yeah, that's where a lot of it historically was, and especially around the Kankakee River in the far south portion of the county. Probably the south quarter of the county used to be all a marsh, a wetland, which was drained in the early 1900s to create some really good farmland that we have now. But that land kind of always wants to return to that state. So it's kind of a constant battle, making sure that we maintain these waterways. And also, like I said, the Katie Marsh Ditch area and other areas in North Lake County were historically wetlands that were drained and then developed. So it's kind of a constant maintenance of these waterways that we have to do to make sure that people don't flood.
That's probably the most important thing. We note here it's because of all of this development going from agricultural land to being developed in one way or the other, and it even comes down to, I guess, when you have big parking lots, you have additional problems that make it more difficult to get the ditches to drain properly.
That's a really good point. So with the unincorporated areas, which we control the development in, and almost, I think, well, every municipality has ordinances that are very similar that require new developments to detain that water that runs off the buildings and the impervious areas so that it releases at a slower rate and doesn't harm anybody downstream.
What would you say as far as the areas that either are flood-prone the most or do actually flood the most are ones that you and your crews at the surveyor's office have to keep the closest eye on the ditches to make sure that they are flowing as they should?
We see a lot of issues down by the Kankakee River in our jurisdiction that just historically it's been a lot of issues down there. So we spend a lot of time in that area. We're also working right now with the state of Indiana and all the eight counties that border or that the Kankakee River goes through. We're working with those counties to come up with a plan for better maintenance and kind of management of the river. And the state's been great to work with on that, and we've been working on that through the KRBC. We also see a lot of issues on Hart Ditch in Dyer in Munster, and we're working with the Little Calumet River Basin and the towns of Highland and Munster and Dyer to address some of those issues right now as well.
Now, I know that your department has basically four people that work with you full-time on keeping these ditches well-maintained, and you probably have to hire some extra help in the summer months, too, to get more work done, don't you?
Yeah, we do. So all winter we see obstruction, so we've been trying to keep a kind of a skeleton crew on the drainage crew throughout the winter to address these issues. But the summer months, when we see a lot of the rain and a lot of the trees fall in that we need to get taken out, we do have four-member crews that work throughout the summer independently and sometimes together, depending on if it's a really big job. But on the smaller jobs, we can sometimes split them up to make them even more efficient.
What do the crews typically do when they go in? I'm sure they have a list if they haven't checked it out themselves. You've kept them posted on what has to be done in a particular area. What do they have to do when they go in to do some maintenance work, to some cleanup work, I guess?
Yeah, so basically it all starts with me and my drainage administrator. We actually reached out to Jerome Prince this year. He has a really cool program through a company called Nearmap that does aerial photography a little more frequently than we have in the past because it's getting more cost effective to do that. And so we look at that kind of more current aerial photography. I think the last one we have is from late September to find these obstructions in remote areas that are really hard to get to sometimes to inspect physically. So we find these obstructions and then we drop the coordinates to our crew, and that they go out. First thing is to make sure that it's safe to do by hand, that we don't need to hire a contractor with a machine to do it. And if they can do it, then they go in actually by hand and waders, and a lot of times they fall in, but that's part of the job too.
It's probably an occupational hazard, you know, especially if you're in the water. Yeah.
Yeah, which is not bad in the hot summer months. Sometimes they enjoy it. So. And so they go in with the chainsaws by hand and usually with ropes, rip out the obstruction and put it in a place where it won't wash back in. And then they also have a winch on one of the trucks that they can use if the obstruction's too big.
Now you talked about having contractors that help you out if it gets too big. What equipment do they bring in to be able to help clear things out if you need them?
Yeah, so we generally just an excavator, a regular excavator. We do have one contractor that we're in touch with who has actually a floating machine excavator that can get into areas that some can't. But that, again, that gets very expensive to do, just to mobilize that machinery and have contractors come out. So, and that's kind of the prices that we use to compare what we spent on our seasonal drainage crew. $433,632 of savings as of October 25th.
I'm sure the Lake County Commissioners probably appreciate that work that they'll be able to do with their own people as opposed to having to hire additional crews.
Oh, they absolutely do, and I think the council is really happy about it too, because we're always looking for ways to save money.
What can you plan for work in 2019?
Well, I think it's going to be more of the same. These obstructions are kind of constantly happening, especially, you know, with the wind that we have, for example, the last couple of days. There's going to be a lot of trees down and obstructions in our waterways. So it's a constant battle, really.
Bill Emerson's department manages more than 600 miles of ditches outside the cities and towns and in unincorporated Lake County townships. This is Regionally Speaking. Crown Point resident Heather Zickovich accepted a task last year that was her late father's wish, to complete and publish a children's Christmas book. The book, co-authored by her dad, Bob Morgan, and herself, is entitled, Is My Grandpa Santa's Elf? Heather and I sat down here at Lakeshore Public Radio to talk about her dad and about the journey that led to the book that was published this past November. Tell us about your dad, what he really wanted to do and never seemed to tell anybody about.
My dad, he had a very big personality and lots of dreams and big dreams. He never really went small. And I think he just wanted to leave behind this gift for us to have, like this legacy that will be here long after I'm here. And he just really wanted a part of him still here with us. So it was really cool to find.
When did you learn that even an idea that he had these plans and goals to write a children's book?
Well, years ago, he's always had projects or just little ideas he was working on for years. And years ago, he mentioned something about it, and I probably gave him the yeah, okay, but I kind of forgot about it. And then it was literally probably about 3 or 4 hours before he passed, and we were in his hospital room, and he had one of those CPAP machines on, and he took it off, and he's like, hey, Heath, come here. I'm like, what's up, Dad? Just relax. You're okay. And he said, sign on to that computer over there. It was the hospital computer. And I said, Dad, I can't do that. And he's like, I want to show you something I've been working on. And I said, okay. I said, well, what is it? He's like, a children's book that I started, you know, back 4 or 5 years ago that I want you to find and finish for me. And I said, you know what, Dad? I'll do whatever. You know, sure. As you know, I'll find it as soon as I get home. I'll find everything and I'll do it for you. And he kind of, you could tell it was kind of on that bucket list of last few thoughts, you know. And he's like, okay. And then he was kind of like, thanks, you know. And it kind of just checked that off his list. And he's like, all right, that's cool. You'll do it. And I went and sat back down where I was sitting by him, and I said, Dad, I will finish it for you. And he's like, all right, thanks, Heather.
Now, when was that, by the way?
So he passed away April of 2017. Mm-hmm. So last year.
So it's been within less than 2 years now, actually, for the whole process to begin. What did, as soon as your father passed and you had to go through the ordeal that everybody goes through when a loved one passes away, and you kind of dust things off and pick things up and figure out, well, what do we do with this? Yeah. What got you started to get onto the actual journey that you had now to follow through on what your dad wanted you to do?
Literally, he passed away in Indianapolis, and literally the next, that morning when we got home, because he passed away around 7 in the morning, that morning, 9, 10 o'clock, I went to his house, and I was just on a mission because I felt like it was a part of, it was meant to be that way, and I was just ready to just find everything and get started and just use it as a way to keep our relationship going, you know? And so I literally went home, got on his computer, found print. He told me where to find, like, the different files he saved, found it, printed everything I could. And the crazy part is, you know, like a week later, his computer bit the dust.
Really?
Yeah.
What a good timing that you did everything just before
everything would
have locked up and you'd had to go to an IT specialist to get it unlocked, I suppose, and get all that back out. Well, tell us now, did he leave you enough files that you could actually go through? Did he lay things out enough, well enough, that you could take everything together, the copy, the pictures, and everything together, and with the right kind of professional help to get on the road to getting this thing published?
Yep. He basically had... the first thing I found was his whole idea, which my dad had, like I said, big ideas, and he always was in excess. And so tons of run-on sentences, you know, I had to go through and weed out. But his main idea was there on a couple of sheets of paper that, you know, I want it to be told in the voice of my oldest granddaughter. Her name was Chloe. He called her Kay Rose. So that's who tells the story in the book. So he... had everything laid out pretty much, but I had to kind of figure out an ending of the book. So the main chunk of the book is him, and then the ending was more me.
Do you think that maybe this layout was including the pitch that you knew that he would have to make if he was able to do it himself to some publisher to tell him, this is why I want you to do my book?
Do I what?
It's like pitching an idea for a movie or something like that. But in this case, you'd have to be pitching it to a publisher about telling him, "said this is why I want you to put my book into print."
I always said, "Leave it to him to, you know, move to heaven and you know leave this world on a promotional marketing thing because that was his whole life. He, you know, was so creative and had just such a love for cool things and just." He never had a small dream, you know, so him going out of this world on this kind of, you know, that not made it easy, but his story behind it made it a good marketing thing. So really it was like he did his own marketing before he left.
Now we know what the title is. We know the ideas that your dad had put into that computer that you've been able to retrieve and start out on the mission. What did you do when you had a chance with your hands, so to speak, on all those files to actually get it to go to the publisher and say, here's what he's got, an idea, here's what he wants us to do?
I just really spent a lot of late nights. I mean, with grief as it is, you can't sleep well. So I spent a lot of those late nights just up till 2 to 4 o'clock in the morning just submitting everywhere, you know, nothing was too small. So really it's just about not giving up and just being persistent. And I mean, you're going to get mostly no's. And then, you know, Mascot Publishing is a smaller publisher, but it was perfect for us. So I just didn't give up, and I was persistent, and it worked out.
Now, who did you get in touch with at the publishing house? Which editors did you get to work with who took on this project?
His name was Daniel Wheatley. He was the project manager for it, and he just kind of, it was a lot of mostly me and then submitting to him and them more so like editing and, you know, cleaning it up and putting it, you know, bringing it to life. He was the main guy I worked with there, but everyone I worked with there was very good to work for.
You tell us about the fellow who was the project manager. What did he tell you, or you probably learned along the way, that he had to do to take the information that you got from your dad, from the computer, and sent on to him to be able to get it to finally be in print?
So basically you have an idea, and then you create a manuscript and just clean up, spend lots and lots of time cleaning up that manuscript. And then you go back and forth a lot, and then you submit the clean final version of the manuscript. And then they turn that into, you know, actually after that, then you find an illustrator. They sent me a big list of people, mm-hmm. and I had to choose, you know, the work that I thought, the whole time I was thinking in my dad's brain, you know. And I had to choose from a whole bunch. The illustrator actually is Monica Nicolsi. She's from Italy, which I thought was pretty cool. And so I chose the illustrator. We went, you know, with a storyboard, did that, and then just kind of cleaned up the whole book.
One of the folks at Purdue University Northwest had to say about this. I'm sure you probably got hold of some folks in the communications department and got a little advice along the way to help you through this process.
Right. Actually, my counselor at Purdue was Beth Rudnick, and she has been amazing. And she, you know, spread the word at Purdue. And so they actually contacted me, and, you know, I talked to a few different people there, and they have just been a huge help through this all. I grew up like a really shy kid, but going to school at Purdue and just the different professors and different, I majored in is liberal studies with an emphasis in communications and OLS, and just that whole, like, I stayed home and went to college, but it just gave me confidence. That mm-hmm. school, if anything, just gave me confidence, and just everyone I worked with there was amazing. And then just, like I said, full circle even to, you know, have them help me so much with the promotion of my dad's book.
From what you know now, the journey you have taken on this here, what advice would you give to somebody who might be not in the same unfortunate circumstances, but somebody who has taken on this project? Maybe a family member has just decided they don't want to deal with it anymore, but you're not going to give up and you want to take on whatever somebody has already started work on. How would you advise them into following through to making sure they can reach the same sort of goals that you have with this published children's book?
As for a book or in just in general?
We'll try the book and then in general.
Okay. I would just, number one, don't think you can't do it and just never give up and just, you know, give it everything you have, because once it's completed, that's, you know, out there forever. And just be persistent and believe in yourself and have fun.
Now, you have a family, so you have things to take care of here in Northwest Indiana, but do you think that you might have another book in you someplace?
I do. I have 3 kids, and I'm married, and you know what? Actually, I never thought I would say yes, but in October, my mom passed away, so both of my parents have passed away in the past 20 months, and I think I kind of want to do one of my own for her, mm-hmm. so I think I might. I think I would maybe do one.
Well, they say never, you know?
Right.
You never
yeah.
know what's going to happen and the right circumstances come up here. Like
right.
they had when your dad, Bob Morgan, passed away, that maybe you'll find something that'll work too. There's some kind of idea that will work out as well. They say as a nice little tribute to your mom for what had happened.
I kind of have my dad's creative, like I have that side of him. I have a lot of my mom in me, but I have that creativeness of, you know, like I don't think anything's too big, you know, like I could do whatever.
Well, let me ask this. Now, the book is out there. That the publisher has it available. Where can people find Is Grandpa Santa's Elf?
They could find it on Amazon. It's for sale on Amazon. It is at mascot.com. You could buy it there. You could buy it at barnesandnobles.com and booksamillion.com. And I also have a Facebook page. It's Is My Grandpa Santa's Elf? And you can contact me through there. And I have I got about 10 boxes of books. I have only about 15 books left. So that makes me feel, I know.
That's very good. Well, then you're going to have to, they'll have to do a second printing there before too long,
next year.
If it catches on. That's
yeah.
great. That's great. Well, Heather, thank you very much for spending time
thank
with us
you.
To talk about the experiences that you've had to go through, unfortunately, that have turned much to your benefit. And everybody else who gets a copy of Is My Grandpa Santa's Elf will learn a true story and sends a really nice message of love and kindness to anybody who picks it up, and especially if you have the young people in your family sit with you and look at the words and follow along and look at the pictures as well, too. Thank you for sharing all this with us.
Thank you for having me.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. First responder emergency crews are getting some new training these days so they can handle a call of broken utility poles or power lines down. Selena Weatherwax with Valparaiso-based Multi-Agency Academic Cooperative, or MAC for short, says this new program is being supported by funds from the NiSource Foundation and with equipment donations as well from NIPSCO.
NIPSCO has also installed various utility poles on the campus, as well as donated meters and other pieces of equipment that are being used for training. You know, NIPSCO personnel, when there's an emergency, they have to be sure that the scene is clear before first responders can actually go through when there are power lines involved and or gas leaks, so on and so forth. So they work essentially as the first responder supporting other first responders. So now with this funding, we'll be able to offer additional training opportunities, not only for NIPSCO to work with law enforcement and police officers, I'm sorry, for law enforcement as well as firefighters, but we'll also be able to make sure that they know one another and that they're communicating effectively.
What type of first response do the utility crews make? And NIPSCO is, of course, what we're talking about primarily here. But what do they have to do when they come onto the scene of some type of disaster or an emergency of any sort?
Yeah, for example, one of the live training scenarios that they're developing on the campus is to simulate when a vehicle hits a telephone line or when it hits a utility pole.
Mm-hmm.
When it hits a NIPSCO line and there's live wires that come down as a result of the car accident, the area needs to be secured before firefighters go in and remove the victim, extract the victim from a vehicle. And so NIPSCO employees do that. They need to be sure that the lines are safe for everyone that's there responding. So that's one example that comes to mind immediately.
Mm-hmm. How realistic do you have to get, I guess, or you probably want to be as realistic as you possibly can so that those who are undergoing training really know what it's like? They don't want to obviously come into a live wire situation really, but you want to pretend something to make sure that they understand that this is what it could very well be like in real life.
Exactly. And, you know, a piece of this will also be around the classroom education side. So there will be quite a bit of instruction prior to utilizing some of these different pieces out on the actual campus.
How long did it take to arrange for all of this to come together in working with NiSource Foundation as well as with NIPSCO to come up with this way to create this training program?
We've been in conversations for, I would say, close to a year now, but Rick Kalinske, who serves as one of their public affairs managers, really stepped up in a big way and offered up his expertise in making it so that it was advantageous to both entities. And as a result, we were successful in the grant process and are looking for ways to continue to grow this partnership.
Now, they get this program started here. How far do you want to take it? What might be the next steps that you and the folks with NIPSCO want to go through?
Well, we at the MAC are specifically focusing on ensuring that law enforcement has the training space that they need. And so the next phase of the MAC campus is going to be focused heavily on that, specifically canine training, tactical training, and allowing SWAT teams to have additional space. So we're looking to expand the campus and more to come on that this next year, Chris.
I was going to ask if that was what's in the long-range plan to go into 2019, now that we're at the end of 2018.
Yeah, exactly. And then we're also reaching out to our area legislators because, you know, the majority of the work that we've done at the MAC has been as a result of philanthropic investments such as this one that has been provided by the NiSource Foundation. So we're looking to see if there's opportunities at the state level for folks to help us because, again, although the Homeland Security Partnership has been incredibly favorable, but more can be done. And so we're trying to pursue that as well.
I know that we've mentioned here about the fact that first responders get the most benefit of the training here, and then you've also expanded in the program to be able to train high school juniors and seniors to go through a fire and rescue program. That's a part of their career training that they would get through the Porter County Career and Technical Education Center. Are there any other organizations that you're reaching out to, obviously besides NIPSCO, to get them involved in training there at MAC?
Yeah, we're proactively reaching out to folks. And if there's anyone that has interest or they see a fit, I would encourage them to contact us and we can explore and, you know, have that conversation. But, but we're very proactive in engaging community partners and identifying folks that that would be helpful to us and like us helpful to them. We also are looking at ways to always grow and expand our training opportunities. And so the classroom space has been very actively used by various community groups. To give you an example, just last week we had the rapid response hospital team training on our campus, and they train using our classroom space, and that's about 40-50 healthcare professionals that come together. So not necessarily first responders, but people that are instrumental in an event of an emergency. We've already trained over 10,000 students this year alone and have exceeded over 50,000 direct contact training hours. And so we have very ambitious goals, and so we are hitting all those marks and are continuing to push forward onto this next year to make sure that we meet those metrics.
Selena Weatherwax with the Mac Foundation says that besides the NIPSCO equipment and supplies that were donated, the NiSource Foundation donated the $20,000 grant that is getting that program to go. Time now for Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Greg Hertzlieb, the director and chief curator at the Brower Museum of Art at Valparaiso University. Welcome back, Greg.
Well, thanks so much, John. It's always nice to be here.
Yeah, well, you're a good guest, Greg. You're a smart guy, and you have a lot of things to say about interesting visual arts exhibitions. And you have all of the winter shows opening.
Right, right.
On the horizon here.
Looking forward to those.
Yes, January 8th, they're open, but the actual opening event for these exhibits is on Sunday, January the 13th, so at 2 in the afternoon, so you have little refreshments and so forth.
Absolutely.
So the first, I would say, as the main exhibit,
right.
One would say, is Line, Force, Burn, Rubber, featuring Sarah Krepp and Olivia Petrides.
That's right. Now, the two of them like to show together, and their work goes well together, mm-hmm. even though it's very different. Well, they both have a black and white thing going mm-hmm. on in their work, mainly black and white. Olivia does large-scale ink and gouache drawings on paper, mm-hmm. huge, mm-hmm. giant. And then Sarah does large-scale works also, but she's dealing with paint, but also with tire retread.
Okay.
She'll treat the tire retread almost like a drawing medium.
So the tire tread is printed onto
Actually
the
adhered, like a collage element.
So there's a thickness to
right,
it.
Right, exactly right. Yeah, and when you look at it at first, you're like, oh, that looks like a stroke of paint, and then you get up close, and it's a piece of tire.
Like you might see in the middle of the Borman Expressway.
Exactly right, right.
And hope you don't hit it.
Yep, exactly right.
And where are these ladies from?
They're both from Chicago, mm-hmm. and they work independently, but then they also are good friends, mm-hmm. and so they'll have exhibitions together in various places, and so they approach the Brower together.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the work and thought about the way that it related and mm-hmm. met the two of them, and it's just a really nice opportunity. Looking forward to it.
Now, so you have three shows going on in separate galleries adjacent to one another.
Right, exactly.
So the shows don't necessarily relate to one another.
Right, right. Now, Sarah and Olivia would be one show, mm-hmm. and then the next one, I think it would be Lynn Olson.
Yes, The Art of Lynn Olson. Tell us about that.
Now, he's a Northwest Indiana artist, and his work is entirely different from Sarah and Olivia. He's a sculptor, and he's working mainly with concrete.
Okay.
He passed away in, I think, 2002 or 2012, but the concrete approach that he used, it looks almost like marble. I mean, you can't even believe
really?
It. Just elegant, very wow. smooth and marbled and textured, and people look at it, are you sure this is concrete? Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, not marble, but it's really amazing.
And where did Lynn live in Northwest?
He was in Valparaiso for a long time,
okay.
and then the executor of his estate is out in Crown Point.
So his work has been still at a studio of his
right,
for
exactly.
all these years?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he did both exterior and interior pieces,
yeah.
Depending on his interest.
Yeah, wow. And then the third exhibit is called The Icons on Ammo Boxes.
Right. And those are two Ukrainian artists, Oleksandr Klemenko and Sofia Antlova. And the two of them take icon or the two of them take ammo box lids and paint icons on them. So okay. It's the stuff from war that right. has become redeemed through this new life.
Yes.
I'm very excited about that.
And are they religious icons?
Right, right. So they would be like an Orthodox – the two artists are Ukrainian, and so this would be an Orthodox mm-hmm. icon. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not super knowledgeable about icons, but when I look at them, it has that medieval styling.
Yeah,
and very
I love that kind of
– beautiful.
Russian icon, and of course, the Ukraine would be related to.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And imagine those icon images on ammo box lids, and that's what you have with this show.
Have you ever seen those? They're kind of akin to Oriental rugs. I think they're from Afghanistan, and they have tanks woven into them.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of those. Those are amazing.
They really are.
Yeah.
Sometimes
a machine
about.
Gun?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I can't even believe it.
I know. Well, that's contemporary life in those places.
That's right. That's right.
So there will be a lecture on Eyewitnessing the War in Ukraine on Friday, January 18th in Duesenberg Recital Hall at 7.
Right. That's with Cyril Hovren is the speaker, mm-hmm. and he is familiar with the work of both artists, but he'll be talking about the larger context that gave rise to the work.
Okay. And also you have a gallery talk with your Line Force Burn Rubber artists. No, that's not true. That's also with the icon artists on January 18th.
Right, right. Just after Cyril's lecture,
yes.
Then we'll go in and see the work, and the artists will talk about it in the gallery.
Okay. And finally, there's a talk with Sarah Krepp and Olivia Petrides on February 13th. Well,
right.
Great. Good shows. I look
thank
forward
you.
To seeing them, Greg.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here, and thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And you can hear this conversation and previous editions of Eye on the Arts online on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. And tune in next Monday here on Regionally Speaking for another Eye on the Arts conversation here on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.